a nice crowd. You guys aren't tired yet. I don't see a whole lot of shopping bags. I haven't purchased enough yet. So this is another day. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Steve Heil. I'll be talking tomorrow on the Kepler mission. And I have a great pleasure this afternoon to introduce our speaker. He's probably no stranger to most of you. Professor Alex Polpenko from the University of California, Berkeley is here today. It's a great, great honor for all of us to have him here. And the best part is to pick his brain when he's not on stage. You can ask him all kinds of interesting questions. And then he tells you the real answer, not the stuff he showed you on the slides. Alex received his PhD at Caltech in 1984. His work centers on supernovae, active galaxies, gamma ray bursts, black holes, and robotic telescopes. Mostly all things that are very far away in the universe and have to do with acceleration of the universe and large-scale structure, fate, and livelihood of the universe. Things where we don't often cross paths. I tend to work a lot on extrasolar planets. My objects are much closer than his. So it's a real nice pleasure to see him as well personally here at this meeting. I mean, he's been one of the leaders in the discovery of dark energy, and some of you that don't really like that, I know this morning a few of you were down against it, so grill him after his talk about dark energy and make sure that he can convince you that it's really true and all that, and the universe is really accelerating. He's won numerous awards, written and co-authored many books. He has been the outstanding teacher in the country and at his university. In fact, he told me that just today, while he's here at this very meeting, he won the award at Berkeley for being the best professor on campus. Is it 6 years in a row or 8 years in a row?
Eight out of the last 12.
So he's here today. So Alex also was elected to the National Academy of Sciences, and that's not something that happens to many people who are scientists. So it's also a real pleasure to have somebody of that stature here today. I have a quote from Alex that I wanted to share with you. He doesn't know what quote this is going to be, but I'm 95% convinced that he really said these words, and it's a great lead-in to his talk. The quote goes like this. He says, "Yes, this is a very strange object. It looks terrible. It looks awful. Yeah, that's definitely a supernova." So with that lead-in, a man who knows his supernova, he's here today to talk about hearts of darkness, black holes in space. I'll give you Dr. Alex Polpenko.
Well, thank you, Steve, for that lovely introduction. I don't recall saying that, but I probably did. The trouble is sometimes you look at the images that you take of the sky when searching for exploding stars, and they have a bunch of junk on them, as well as the real thing. And the hard part sometimes is distinguishing between the two, so I may well have said it. Anyway, thank you all for being here. This is really one of the premier conferences of its type in the country. And I'm particularly grateful that so many of you are so dedicated to bringing astronomy to the general public. I know today it's raining, but if it were not raining, we'd have a bunch of solar telescopes set up out there. With which to look at prominences and other things that you saw this afternoon in the interesting presentations. But anyway, continue to do your daytime star parties, or solar parties, and your nighttime parties as well. It really is wonderful to bring our science to the general public and to have such enthusiastic participants in this endeavor. Anyway, last year I spoke here on supernovae per se, and today I thought I'd talk about one form of their aftermath, black holes. Now, many of them form neutron stars or nothing at all, just the complete disintegration of a white dwarf. But I thought I'd talk about black holes, which is one possible end state for the evolution of stars. So what is a black hole? Very simply, a black hole is a region in space where matter has been compressed to such a high density, such a high mass, stream, and volume, that the local gravitational field is strong enough to retain everything. So nothing can escape. Apples can't escape, rockets can't escape, not even light can escape. So no light escapes, no light is transmitted, no light is reflected, there's just no light whatsoever. And so they're called black holes, they look black. And here's my prize-winning photograph of a black hole. Okay, normal selling price is $10,000. But for you, special deal, 5K, see me afterwards. Or you can just keep the lens cap on your camera. Oops, I'm giving away a trade secret here. Or if you're using PowerPoint or Keynote, just choose a black background and have no other stuff in it. Anyway, so it's not such a secret anymore. So to quote from Dante's Inferno, abandon all hope, ye who enter here. Because if you get caught within the gravitational clutch of a black hole, you will never escape. So definitely abandon hope. And by the way, once you cross the so-called boundary, that event horizon, it's just a very, very short time before you get squished into a point of zero or nearly zero volume, the singularity. I think for the 4 million solar mass black hole in the middle of our galaxy, which I'll be telling you about, but I know many of you have heard of it already, the maximum time to live once you cross the event horizon is about a minute. And in fact, you get torn apart before you get squished into the singularity. So, black holes, of course, are popular in pop culture, science fiction books and movies. This going back to the 1979 Disney movie, The Black Hole, a journey that begins where everything else ends. Steve, did you make that with my laser pointer? That's amazing. I think it may have gone down a black hole. That's really strange, huh? It's in a pocket, maybe it's in my, here we go, along with myself. All right, so anyway, journey that begins where everything ends, and then here's another one, event horizon, the boundary of a black hole, infinite space, infinite terror. Well, as far as I can tell, this movie at least had very little to do with black holes, but you know, it's an attractive subject. Black holes kind of suck you in. And here's a graphic novel by Charles Burns based on his series of comics. It's called Black Hole. And again, it has very little to do with black holes. It's about these kids in Seattle that get some terrible disease that turns them into zombies. But in any case, it's called Black Hole, and people read it in part because they're interested in this subject. Greeting cards, here's one. This card is late. Another black hole starts to form, and wouldn't you know it, right in Sid's room. Well, I hope to convince you today that black holes form only under certain very special circumstances. They don't typically, in fact, they never form in Sid's room or your room or any other. But here's Sid's dog and a bunch of other things being sucked into this black hole. Anyway, you might think that black holes don't exist in nature, but they do. In fact, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area in Oakland, and locally we have an excellent example of a black hole. You see, there's this black hole zone in the Oakland Raiders' most rabid fan section. You see that these guys are foaming at the mouth and stuff. I think they call themselves the Black Hole Zone because any innocent passerby who's wandering by that area gets sucked in by these rabid fans of the Oakland Raiders, never to be released into the real world once again. So there you go. They're all wearing their t-shirts, the Black Hole. So black holes are pretty fierce places, you know, they draw you in and hold on tight. Astronomers like to say, what happens in a black hole stays in a black hole. So the black holes are the astronomer's version of Las Vegas, okay? The fabulous black hole Nevada. What happens in black holes stays in black holes. Well, all joking aside, you might wonder why study these things. Of course, to people interested in astronomy, they're such a fascinating subject, and so I'm preaching to the choir here. But for most people, you know, they don't really know why they should study black holes. But you can point out that former President Bill Clinton, in his year 2000 science and technology policy address, referred to them. There are so many more questions yet to be answered. And so I wonder, are we alone in the universe? What causes gamma ray bursts? What's in those black holes anyway, you know? So if the President of the United States or his speechwriter show interest in black holes, then you know they've got to be pretty important. Maybe not quite as important as Social Security and Medicare and all that, but nevertheless, pretty important that they place, so there's a good reason to study them. All right, well, let's get back to the definition and examine it in a little bit more detail. Black holes are regions where the local gravity is so strong that nothing, not even light, can escape. Now, you need Einstein's general theory of relativity to understand this in any detail. But a Newtonian plausibility argument goes back several hundred years. Indeed, Pierre de Laplace and Pierre-Simon Parti de Laplace, I guess his full name, and John Mitchell in the late 18th century discussed the possibility, based on Newton's laws, that the most massive stars in the universe might actually be dark stars because they don't emit the light that's actually produced. And the idea was the following. Let's go and consider one mass, let's say Earth in this case, and another mass, let's say an apple. There's a gravitational force between the Earth and an apple, or between a star and a gas particle in the outer extremities of that star. And that force is directly proportional to the product of the masses and inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them. So, you know, I toss this apple up and it comes back down after a while because of the mutual gravitational attraction between the Earth and an apple. Of course, in a talk about gravity, you can't not use the proverbial Newtonian apple, right? So here it is. All right. Now, suppose I were to keep the Earth's mass the same, but squish the Earth down to half of its present radius, okay? Keep the Earth's mass the same, but compress it. In this case, the apple at the new compressed surface of the Earth will be one half of the distance from the center that it used to be. So the new d will be one half of the old d, and this equation refers to the distance between the centers of mass, so the center of the apple and the center of the Earth. Anyway, d is now one half of what it used to be. One half squared is a quarter, and the reciprocal of a quarter is 4. So the force between the apple and the Earth will be 4 times greater. That means that the deceleration suffered by the apple will be greater, and it'll be harder for me to throw it so fast that it actually escapes from Earth. Now, the escape speed, that speed which you need to get something to never stop and come back down, is some number. It's about 11 kilometers per second for the Earth. And it won't become 4 times bigger. It'll become, it's a function that goes 1 over the square root of the distance, so it'll become the square root of 2 times bigger than it used to be. But nevertheless, it's a bigger escape speed than it used to be because the force is bigger. And if I squish the Earth down even more, then the force between the apple and the Earth becomes even stronger. I would have to throw the apple even faster to get it to escape from the Earth, like a rocket, okay? Well, you can imagine compressing the Earth so much that the escape speed, that speed that's needed to get something to never quite come back down, indeed, at the escape speed, it barely reaches zero speed as it goes an infinite distance away from you, but that speed goes up. And you can imagine that speed becoming so great that it would exceed the speed of light. And in that case, no light would escape from the object. And this is what Laplace and Mitchell were thinking about, that maybe if Newtonian gravity holds, then the most massive stars might have such a strong gravitational force that the escape speed equals or exceeds the speed of light, in which case those stars would appear dark to us. And at that time, in the late 18th century, they didn't know that no material particle can exceed the speed of light, but we now know, based on Einstein's relativity and many, many experiments, that that's the case. You can't throw anything faster than the speed of light, because it would take an infinite amount of energy to do so. So if light can't escape, then apples and rocket ships and other things can't escape as well, and you have a truly black hole. Light doesn't escape, nor do any other objects. Now, that line of reasoning, of course, doesn't quite work for light, because light has no mass formally. It's got energy. A photon has energy, but it doesn't have mass. And so you can't naively apply Newtonian physics. Nevertheless, this plausibility argument turns out to lead you in the right direction. And if you use Einstein's general theory of relativity, a more enhanced, more complete view of gravity, you get the same answer. There is a certain density, a certain mass per unit volume, where the local gravitational field prevents anything, including light, from escaping. And the idea is that gravity is not really a force. Newton's equation works to some degree, but it doesn't give you the fundamental idea of what gravity is. More fundamentally, gravity is a curvature, a warping of both space and time. And the idea is then that the Earth is going around the Sun because it's following its natural path in an intrinsically curved space. And indeed, time itself is warped as well. I'll talk about that a little bit later. So that's the Earth's orbit around here. And I forgot the demo that I was going to bring to show this. But you've seen them at various science museums. You know, you roll a penny along like this. And if there were no friction, it would just continue in a circular or a more generally elliptical orbit forever. But because there is friction, it loses some energy and it spirals in, and that's one way that these museums can make money, one penny at a time. So support your local science museum and planetarium if they have one of these little gizmos, one of these black holes. So the idea is that if you make this denser and denser, the local warping of space into some fourth spatial dimension that I can't point to you. This is just a two-dimensional diagram showing you a simpler analogy. But in real life, our three spatial dimensions warp into some fourth dimension, okay, and objects follow their natural path. But if the density becomes sufficiently great, then the paths all curve around and never escape. And even light can't escape radially away from these things, because if it tries to do so, it uses up all of its energy in trying to escape. So either it goes around like that, in which case it just kind of sits there, the photon has the same energy, but if it actually tries to escape, it's trying to climb out of this warped space and it loses all of its energy, and so in a sense you can think of the photon escaping, but it has no energy by the time it escapes, and so in fact there's nothing to see. That's what we think of as a gravitational redshift in Einstein's relativity. So it leads to the same result as the Newtonian plausibility argument, but in a much more rigorous way. Now, this was a natural consequence of Einstein's theory of relativity, which he published in 1916. But the idea that there might be a boundary like this, an event horizon beyond which we can't see, is due to Karl Schwarzschild, a mathematician who figured out this solution, this consequence, in principle at least, of Einstein's mathematical equations. And he figured this out just months after, or weeks after, receiving the theory from Einstein. Unfortunately, just a few months later, he died on the Russian front, in fact, in World War I. But this boundary is now known in terms of the Schwarzschild radius, in terms of Karl Schwarzschild. And if you were to take the Earth and squish it down until it becomes a black hole, the Schwarzschild radius would be about 1 centimeter. So the Earth would be about the size of a walnut. There's no process we know that would do that to the Earth, but that's how big it would be if you had a cosmic vise that could squish it down enough. The Sun would be only 3 kilometers in radius, about 2 miles in radius, if it were squished down to a point where light can't escape. So right now the Sun's radius is 700,000 kilometers. It would only be 3 kilometers if it were the Schwarzschild radius. So that's after Karl Schwarzschild. Now the term black hole didn't come until decades later, well after Einstein's death, actually, in 1955, when John Wheeler coined the term black hole. And it had been called other things before, like frozen star by Soviet astrophysicists, and other names had been given. But he called these things black holes, and the name stuck, all right? But Einstein never was familiar with that name, okay? He just knew of the mathematical consequences that had been explored by Karl Schwarzschild. And in fact, Einstein thought that this is a curious, interesting mathematical consequence of his equations of general relativity, but Einstein himself couldn't conceive of a natural mechanism by which the universe would produce these black holes, because he said, you know, you really have to squish the Earth down, and you have to squish the Sun down, and there's no mechanism by which to do that. So Einstein did not believe that black holes exist. He thought they were just a mathematical consequence that isn't actually realized in nature. Well, as I'll show you in this talk, we now have very, very good evidence that black holes really do exist. So that evidence comes in two forms, and I'll discuss both of these, but first let me just point out the two areas in the universe where we typically find black holes. We find gigantic ones in the central regions of galaxies, giant collections of stars like this. You're all familiar with what galaxies are. I'll give you the evidence in a few minutes, but we find big ones, millions or even billions of times the mass of the Sun in the central regions of galaxies. And that's where, by a process that's still not entirely understood by astrophysicists, mass, gas can collect up in a sufficiently small volume and continue gravitational collapse until nothing can escape. And again, we're still trying to figure out how that happens. But that's one way of having a cosmic vice. If you have enough gas in the middle of a galaxy, it'll collapse to form a black hole. The other way in which black holes are typically formed is through the explosions as of certain types of stars. Now, only a minority of stars explode, and only a minority of those explosions produce black holes. And in particular, this one, supernova 1987A, produced a neutron star for at least a little while, and what remains may still be a neutron star, but there's also the possibility that it continued to collapse to form a black hole. We just are not sure yet. We saw a neutron star form when the star was first collapsing, but there's been no evidence for the neutron star in the 24 years hence. So maybe it continued to collapse to form the black hole. More generally, we think the kinds of explosions that produce black holes rather than neutron stars are the so-called gamma ray bursts. And those are interesting objects. Roughly once per day, somewhere in the sky, gamma ray satellites see a blast of high energy radiation. Gamma rays, even higher energy than X-rays. And we think that those are associated with the collapse of extremely massive stars. So here's a NASA simulation zooming in on the core of a massive star that's rotating, and near the end of its life, it collapses to form a black hole. There's a lot of energized material in the surroundings, and that forms a jet along the rotation axis that pummels through the star, goes out through the star into two oppositely directed beams, and if we happen to be looking down one of the beams, then we see a very, very bright burst like this. And if we're not looking down one of the beams, then we see a more or less normal brightness exploding star. Because even though the central parts of the star are collapsing, other parts explode away in the aftermath of this collapse. But in particular, you get this jet of particles that goes through the path of least resistance out through the star, and that's where the density of the star is lowest, along the rotation axis, forming these relativistic jets, and if you're looking along one of them, you see a gamma ray burst. But, you know, what really happened is a massive star collapsed in its central regions, forming, we think, a black hole, and the process of gravitational collapse releases a lot of energy to the surrounding particles, and some of them escape along these jets. Nothing is coming out from within the black hole. The press often gets this right. It's just that there are a bunch of highly energized particles resulting from the release of a lot of energy through this gravitational collapse, and some of them escape along the path of least resistance, the rotational axis of this star. So that gives rise to a gamma ray burst. Another way of getting a gamma ray burst, we think, is when two neutron stars, the aftermath of more or less normal stellar explosions, are so close together that they start spiraling in because they're emitting gravitational waves. So waves of energy are being emitted. That brings the two stars closer until they merge, form a black hole, and along the axis, the orbital axis, the jets go flying out. Now, this was another one of these very fancy, expensive NASA animations. But it has one glaring flaw. Let's see if I can see a show of hands of how many of you think you noticed what the glaring flaw in that animation. Maybe a few people. Want to yell out what you think it was?
From the wrong axis.
Yeah, it's off-axis, absolutely so. Let me show it again. All right, so here's the orbital axis of these two neutron stars. You see it's perpendicular to the screen. It's along your line of sight. So the axis, the orbital axis, is like that, right? This thing forms a merged object whose rotation axis is this way. Not, it should have gone out this way, right? Not that way. So they spend all this money on a really cool animation and they get something fundamentally wrong. Anyway, it's kind of fun. So you get these gamma ray bursts, and either from the collapse of a massive star or from the merging of two neutron stars to form a black hole. And so either way, we think gamma ray bursts are the birthplace of black holes. So many astronomers are very interested in gamma ray bursts, both because they're a very brilliant phenomenon and because we think this is where black holes are actually formed, at least in the case of stellar mass black holes. The trouble is that most gamma ray satellites only tell you approximately where the gamma rays come from. And it's hard to study an object at other wavelengths if you don't know where that object is, and you can't, say, study the optical light and the radio waves and the infrared light. After all, if all we know is that the gamma rays came from somewhere over here, well, there's a lot of possible optical counterparts. And to give you a sense of scale, here's the full moon, and the typical uncertainty region of these gamma ray satellites, not all of them, but some of them, especially until the SWIFT satellite went up, a lot of the gamma ray satellites had uncertainty circles whose radius was several degrees, okay? And within that error circle, there are hundreds or thousands of stars and even more galaxies if you go out to 10 billion light years or something. So where's the optical counterpart? It's hard to really understand the physics of something if all you have are the gamma rays. Astronomers want to study the phenomenon at other wavelengths. So the name of the game is, you know, localization, 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 right? You need to know where this thing is. And this is where amateur astronomers have contributed and can continue to contribute to professional astronomy. You have access to small telescopes and cameras that can look at wide areas of the sky. You know, with the Keck telescope, I'm usually looking at an arc minute or so, or even a couple of arc seconds, okay? But you have these cameras that can take rapid-fire pictures of wide parts of the sky. And here's an example that was actually run by a professional group, but there was no reason it couldn't have been run by an amateur group. This is ROTCE. And in 1999, they saw the optical afterglow of a gamma ray burst, and when a spectrum was taken of the galaxy in which that gamma ray burst occurred, it was found that that galaxy is about halfway across the observable part of the universe. And yet, optically, this particular afterglow reached ninth magnitude. So for those of you, and I know it's many, but not all, who know what magnitudes are, this is an object that could have been seen through a good pair of binoculars if you were looking at the right part of the sky at the right time, okay? And an even better example of this is this object, a gamma ray burst on March 18th, 2008, and the Polish Pie on the Sky experiment, where again, it's some professional astronomers, but they have lots of help, I think, also from amateur groups. They have set up a wide-angle camera in Chile, not in Poland, but weather is typically bad in Poland, but in the Chilean Andes, it's much better. And they actually caught the optical afterglow of this gamma ray burst. There it is, okay, so there is nothing, and there it is, and then it faded. And this thing reached a bit brighter than sixth magnitude. So that means on a dark moonless night, it's visible to the unaided eye. And yet, this thing was something like half the distance across the visible universe as well, okay? So if you were looking at the right place at the right time, you could have seen this thing with the naked eye. Now, admittedly, this was sort of the gamma ray burst of the century so far, or at least the past few decades. It's the brightest afterglow we know of. But, you know, we're not asking for naked eye visibility. With your cameras, you can take snapshots of the sky, reach considerably deeper than your eye does, and possibly find the optical afterglow of a gamma ray burst. And that would be something that professional astronomers would give you great kudos for. And so, because, you know, again, we want to study these things. So that's the way you can contribute. Okay, so gas collects up in the central parts of galaxies, forming black holes, and we think certain types of stars collapse or merge together, forming black holes as well. How do you actually verify these ideas? I mean, you know, these are still just ideas, right? How do you actually find black holes that you can study? Well, you might think it's not so hard. Just take lots and lots of photographs repeatedly of the same parts of the sky and look for arrows. And, you know, here these arrows are pointing at a bunch of places that look dark, you know, so maybe those are black holes. Well, you know, it can't be that easy, otherwise we wouldn't give degrees for this kind of work, right? Plus, you know, a black portion of the sky could simply be the absence of stars or the absence of galaxies in your photograph. It can't be that easy. But there are a number of cartoons based on this principle. It's black, and it looks like a hole. I'd say it's a black hole, right? Again, it's not that easy, all right? But it's not, you know, it's not really rocket science. You can take stars that are orbiting one another. And as many of you know, many, if not most of the stars you see in the sky are actually binary systems like this. So there are two or more stars going around each other. Okay, so you're stopping here. They're actually going around their common center of mass, but from the perspective of either one, the other one is going around it. So that's fine, okay? And you can tell that even the apparently single stars are this way, even if through a telescope you can't see the individual stars. I mean, they might be too close together to resolve even with your telescope. But if you pass the light from this apparently single star through a prism or a grating or something and disperse it into a spectrum, you'll see all these absorption lines formed by calcium or sodium, or sorry, this one's sodium, that's calcium down there. Hydrogen alpha, there was a nice talk on using H-alpha filters to look at prominences. Well, there's that same line in absorption, okay, and caused by the absorption in the photosphere of zillions of atoms in the atmosphere of that star, in the photosphere of that star. And if that star is, if there's a pair of stars and they're going around a common center of mass, then you'll see that absorption line shifting back and forth to first shorter wavelengths if it's going toward you, and then longer wavelengths if it's going away from you, okay? So, you know, you imagine these two guys, and one of the stars, if you're looking from over here, will be going towards you, so it'll have a blue-shifted set of absorption lines. The other one at the same moment was going away from you, so it'll have a red-shifted set of absorption lines, and you'll see two pairs of absorption lines there. And then a little bit later, you'll see two pairs of absorption lines, but they'll have switched back around because the star that used to be going toward you is now going away from you. This is just a familiar audible Doppler effect, but in this case, we're looking at it in the form of light. So you look at these spectra of stars over the course of a night or many months, and you can see that there are two pairs of absorption lines. Okay, great. What does that have to do with black holes? Well, what if you only see one set of absorption lines, yet it's going back and forth? Well, that could be because one of the stars, generally the more massive star, collapsed and formed a black hole, and the rest of it may have exploded. The mass, or at least some of the mass, is still there. That part that wasn't ejected is still there. The orbit may have changed, because some of the mass was lost, but the two stars are still bound. They can remain bound in certain cases, even after the explosion. So this star and this black hole will still be going around their common center of mass, but you will see light only from the star that emits light. And so you'll see a single set of absorption lines going back and forth. And if you measure the speed with which they complete one back and forth period, and if you measure the wavelength shift of these lines, and you can convert that with the Doppler formula into a speed, so you can tell the orbital speed. And if you then use Newton's laws and combine the orbital speed with the orbital period, you can figure out how massive is the object that's pulling on the other object, that is, that's making it orbit. And if that mass exceeds three or four solar masses, yet is dark, then the process of illumination tells you that this thing is probably a black hole, because it can't be a normal star that massive and yet be dark, because a normal star should be really bright. And no white dwarf can be three times the mass of the sun. That exceeds the mass limit of a white dwarf. And no neutron star, we think, can be more than three solar masses. So the point is, if you find a dark object which dynamically gives you a mass greater than about three or four solar masses, then it's likely to be a black hole. But there's a lot of stars in the sky. Where do you look? I mean, we don't have enough telescope time with which to monitor the spectra of lots and lots of stars in the sky. So we need a clue. We need to know which ones are most likely to yield a black hole. That clue comes from the X-rays. If the two stars are close enough together, then the black hole, or maybe it's a neutron star or a white dwarf, whatever, it steals material from the other star. And that material forms what's called an accretion disk. And in the case of a very compact object, either a neutron star or a black hole, material is falling into such a strong gravitational field that it's gaining a lot of bulk kinetic energy, yet all these particles are hitting one another, and they heat up and emit radiant energy, electromagnetic energy. But if the gas heats up enough, then that electromagnetic energy can be high-energy radiation, X-rays. So you look for stars that emit a lot of X-rays. And these things also can emit bursts of X-rays when a clump of gas that forms in this disk falls toward the neutron star or the black hole. It emits a lot of energy in a short amount of time, emitting a burst of X-rays. Now, normally, stars don't emit a lot of X-rays. I mean, the sun emits some X-ray radiation, but not a lot. And it doesn't do huge bursts. I mean, the flares that were discussed this morning, the X flares, they emit X-rays, but not gigantic amounts of X-rays. And they might be harmful to us, but they're not gigantic on a cosmic scale. But if you find a star that's emitting a lot of X-rays, and especially in bursts like this, then that suggests that it's orbiting a compact object that's either a neutron star or a black hole. And it's worthwhile then to follow the visible star and see whether dynamically you're finding evidence of a black hole. Well, these things brighten not only X-ray wavelengths, which are detected by, for example, the Chandra X-ray Observatory, but also at other wavelengths, ultraviolet, invisible, infrared. The whole accretion disk brightens and a whole big blob falls onto, into the central regions. So even at optical wavelengths, you get what's called a nova. Now, most novas are not due to stuff falling onto either a neutron star or a black hole. Most novas are surface nuclear reactions on the surfaces of white dwarfs. But some novas could be through this process of clumpy accretion onto a neutron star or a black hole. So if you find one of these things, and this is why astronomers are interested also in amateur discoveries of novae, you guys can scan much of the sky and find these things. Some of them might be black hole candidates. And one that the Japanese Ginga satellite found a few decades ago went by this phone number, Ginga satellite 2000+25, that's a declination, right? Ascension was around 20 hours or so. And when it went off, I was kind of interested, and I said to my team of grad students, well, let's watch this thing as it fades. Someday, maybe it'll fade enough that the light won't be dominated by the accretion disk anymore, but rather by the star that donated material. And indeed, in the mid-90s, it faded from, something kind of like this. This isn't the picture of it, but it was something kind of like this, down to that. And I wrote a proposal for the Keck telescopes. There was only one at the time, there were two. Sorry, this was just when number two had been built. And I said, I want to watch this thing for a night or a couple of nights and see whether I can get the radial velocity curve. So I used one of the Keck telescopes in Hawaii. It was a beautiful summer night. We had 8 hours. We took 13 spectra of this faint little star. It's a faint star, so you need a big telescope in order to disperse the light enough to see the little absorption lines. But the Keck telescopes are 10 meters in diameter. Here's Fred Chaffee, a former director of the Keck telescope, showing it, what it looks like. It's 36 1.8-meter segments, all working beautifully in unison. By the way, he usually wasn't there when we were taking data. This is just a PR shot. The extra light-gathering power provided by his eyes doesn't add very much to that of a 10-meter piece of glass. But anyway, it's kind of a cool shot anyway. And so we get diagrams like this where we can plot the radial velocity, the speed toward us or away from us, as a function of time. And you see a beautiful sinusoid here where at one point the visible star was moving away from us at 520 kilometers per second. A mere 4 hours later in a bit, it was going towards us at 500 kilometers per second, and then back to 520 kilometers per second away from us. And the points in between fit a sinusoid very well. And this is basically the telltale sign of circular motion. And from the speed, 520 kilometers per second, and the period, 8 hours, 8.3 hours, you can just go to Newton's laws. You don't need relativity for this, because the star is kind of pretty far from the compact object. You don't need relativity. But you can figure out that whatever is causing this visible star to move, it must be at least five times as massive as the Sun. And I say at least because we don't necessarily know that the orbit is edge-on, right? It might be tilted. I mean, if it were face-on, then there'd be no radial velocity variations whatsoever, right? It's got to be at least a little bit inclined toward you to get radial velocity variations. But without a transit or an eclipse, what Kepler is finding for the exoplanets now, Steve will talk about it tomorrow, it was mentioned also earlier this afternoon in Chris's talk, but you know, unless the thing is edge-on, you don't get eclipses or transits, you know, so you don't see any diminishing of the light. So, you know, you're at some random angle, and that means only part of the velocity is the radial velocity. If the true velocity is more than what we're measuring, then the true mass of whatever's pulling on the visible star must be more than the five solar masses that we calculate from a naive application of the formula. So we calculated that this thing is at least five times the mass of the Sun, yet it's invisible. No normal stars could be that way. We don't know of any white dwarfs or neutron stars or other weird kinds of stars that could be this way. And so this is a good bet for a black hole. And so when we get good data like this, then we're very happy campers. And now you see the real reason we build observatories in Hawaii. Okay? And I like to go to Hawaii. Anyway, astronomers now know of several dozen very good candidates for these so-called stellar mass black holes. The black holes that are maybe 10 or 20 times the mass of the Sun, or 11 or 9, that one that I just showed you, not that guy, but anyway, this thing we now think is closer to 8 solar masses, because we have other data now that tells something about the inclination. I'm going to tell you about that right now, but we think it's an 8 solar mass dark compact object. More recently, a graduate student of mine and I studied this star here in a nearby galaxy, IC10, and it turns out that this thing is orbiting a black hole that's 20 to 30 solar masses, the most massive, well-documented, compelling case for a stellar mass black hole. So that's a cool one right there. But anyway, astronomers now have several dozen of these things, and you might say, well, you know, your argument was a plausibility argument. You can't think of anything else it could be, and so you call it a black hole. That's true, although, you know, astronomers have studied lots of other things, and, you know, the fact that we say that it can't be anything else is not to be taken lightly. Nor, however, I will admit, is it proof. So you want additional evidence, and we actually have some additional evidence in the following argument. You know, these things could be some sort of weird neutron stars or other stars with some sort of a surface. But in that case, when the material that's accreting into the central region hits the surface, and I lost my apple, but you know, you can easily imagine something hitting a surface and converting its bulk kinetic energy of motion into heat, into radiated light, infrared, optical, and so on. So if stuff is falling onto a hard surface, it should radiate more than if the stuff is falling through the event horizon on the way to some, you know, singularity. Then it won't emit as much. I mean, it'll emit some because there's friction in all these particles here, but at least the thing never hits a hard surface. Well, other astronomers at Harvard and elsewhere have studied the dynamical black hole candidates, that is, those whose unseen object is three solar masses or more, and they've compared them with the X-ray binary stars where we think there's a neutron star, which typically is 1.4 solar masses. So there's a set of neutron star X-ray binaries, and there's a set of black hole candidate X-ray binaries. And lo and behold, in quiescence, that is when these things aren't bursting,
the neutron star X-ray binaries are brighter than the black hole X-ray binaries by a significant factor. So those that we dynamically think are neutron stars show evidence of stuff hitting a hard surface. Those objects which we think dynamically are black holes show not any clear evidence of material hitting a hard surface. So although we haven't actually seen a particle vanish from sight when it goes, you know, too close to the event horizon, the gravitational redshift becomes infinite and stuff, we've seen nearly the next best thing, and that is an absence of the light that you expect when stuff hits a hard surface, okay? So this adds to the plausibility. And I would be willing to bet my house that stellar mass black holes do exist. Now, that's not a very, you know, meaningful bet because I happen to rent, but I would bet my cat, and I know, you know, my wife and I both love our cat, but I would bet my cat that stellar mass black holes really do exist based on this and other evidence. What about the supermassive variety? We think that there's giant ones in the middle of galaxies where a lot of gas could collide. Do we have any evidence that these things do exist? Well, again, the evidence comes from studies of the motions of objects near the black hole, because you can't see the black hole directly. So in the central regions of galaxies, you have a concentration of stars. And those stars pull on each other and cause each other to move. It's the usual thing. It's just like we're orbiting the sun. Well, if you have the stars in addition to that, you have a black hole, then there's more gravity. There's more pull on the stars, and they orbit more quickly. So if you study the central region of a galaxy and you measure the motions of the stars to be pretty fast versus really fast, well, the ones where the stellar motions are really fast are more likely to have a black hole, just because there's extra pull there. Now, the most readily visible galactic center, not at optical wavelengths, but at radio and infrared wavelengths, is the center of our own galaxy, about 26,000 light years away. It's in that box, but this is an optical picture. And all of you know that in Sagittarius, there are all these, you know, dark clouds and stuff that block our view. But nevertheless, the center of our galaxy is in that green box about 26,000 light years away. And in the infrared and at radio wavelengths, you can see it. Just like on a foggy day, you might not be able to see a building that's a few hundred meters away, but you can still hear your favorite radio station. And infrared devices can still pick out objects. So, you look at the galactic center at infrared wavelengths, where stars are reasonably bright. Most stars aren't all that bright at radio wavelengths, and plus the resolution of radio telescopes isn't as good, typically, unless you use interferometers. So infrared is a good way to go. And especially if you use a technique called adaptive optics, which compensates largely for the turbulence in the atmosphere, it can give you crystal clear images with a big telescope of a region of the sky. So here's one arc second, okay? That would be considered pretty good seeing at most of our backyard sites. And indeed, even at Mauna Kea in Hawaii, the seeing is typically only a little bit better than that, maybe 0.7 arc seconds. So, you know, stars would be some big blob, okay? But with adaptive optics, you can see a lot of individual stars here. Indeed, with the Keck 10-meter telescopes, the resolution, the clarity is 4 times better than with Hubble. Now, I'm not dissing Hubble. Hubble's a great telescope. I'm a Hubble hugger, as Dan Golden once accused astronomers of being before the James Webb Space Telescope ballooned into something impossibly expensive. Anyway, you know, Hubble is a great telescope, but over a small field of view, the Keck telescopes actually have, at infrared wavelengths, 4 times better resolution. So Reinhard Genzel and Andrea Ghez, two very famous groups, have been, for close to 20 years now, monitoring the galactic center, first with one type of technique and then with adaptive optics, and what they found is that the stars are moving. Zoom, zoom, look at that. I love this one here, S02. Let's watch that again, okay? Zoom, I love that. That's zoom. Anyway, they're going around in something we call Keplerian orbits. There we go. They're going around in what's called Keplerian orbits, that is, orbits that are well described by the mass being concentrated in a very small volume. Unlike the more distributed mass of a star cluster, where as another star comes in, it gets influenced by different amounts of gravity, and so you know, and so it's not a Keplerian orbit. But here, the evidence is that all the mass causing the orbits of these stars is concentrated right there where that red cross is. And in fact, it's a good thing that it's marked with a red cross because, you know, this is, we think, a black hole. And black holes are dangerous places, so you need a medical station nearby. Anyway, you can calculate using, again, Newton's laws from these orbital parameters that whatever is causing these orbits has a mass of 4 million times the mass of our sun, concentrated in a volume smaller than our solar system. Now, in fact, that's even better evidence for a black hole than the stellar mass black holes, because it's a greater mass density in a small volume, a greater mass in a small volume than is the case for the stellar mass black holes. And so this is, you know, I probably bet my job on this. Now, that's maybe perhaps a bit risky, because, you know, I need to, you know, make money and stuff. But I think I'd be pretty willing to bet my job that there's a black hole in the middle of our galaxy, because any other explanation, and there really aren't any other viable explanations for the guys in the centers of galaxies, but if you were to think of one, it would be really wild. I mean, the conservative conclusion right now is that there's a black hole in the middle of our galaxy. And there's less good evidence, but still quite compelling evidence, from the Hubble Space Telescope and other telescopes for similar massive objects in the central regions of other galaxies. And here's a galaxy that many of you know and love, M87, one of the, you know, the brightest, second brightest galaxy in the Virgo cluster. And it's got a concentration of mass in the central region that indicates something like 3 to 6 billion solar masses. The models are a little bit still unclear on this. For a long time, it was thought to be 3 billion solar masses, but recently astronomers at the University of Texas have published an interesting argument that the mass might be closer to 6 billion solar masses. And, you know, it's within a few central light years. So we don't know that it's concentrated within the size of a solar system. It might be, but we don't have that kind of resolution yet. All we know is that there's 3 to 6 billion solar masses within, I think, the central light year or something like that. But again, that's an almost unfathomable mass density, and no one can think of anything other than a black hole. And even if you squished whatever other explanation you have into a small volume, according to general relativity, we know of nothing that could resist the force of gravity from pulling this thing into the formation of a black hole anyway. So even if you could escape it for a while, maybe make a cluster of stars or something in the central light year, they would quickly merge and form a black hole. It's almost an inevitable consequence of having that much mass in such a small volume. So there's M87. The Sombrero Galaxy, M104, has a 700 million solar mass black hole in it, again, from Hubble motion, or measurements of the motions of stars. Andromeda, our sister galaxy, which in many ways resembles the Milky Way, but it's blessed with a much bigger black hole, that's still somewhat of a mystery. Why does Andromeda Galaxy, M31, have a substantially bigger black hole than our 4 million solar mass black hole in the middle of our Milky Way? Anyway, that's kind of a cool one. And then here's a neat one that has a 40 million solar mass black hole. I think this is NGC 4258. And a puzzle that has come up in the last decade or so is that if you plot the mass of the black hole in the middle of a galaxy versus the mass of the central bulge, you find that the bulgy galaxies, and, you know, M87 being an elliptical galaxy, can be thought of as being entirely bulge-dominated. And then here's the Sombrero Galaxy, which has a big bulge, and somewhat of a disk, but, you know, it's still bulge-dominated. And then our own Milky Way has a smaller bulge, and even smaller galaxies have smaller bulges, you know. So, actually, our Milky Way would be around here, 4 million solar mass black hole. But anyway, you have this progression where somehow the mass, and also, I should say, the concentration toward the center of the bulge knows about the black hole. And a big mystery still in modern astrophysics is, how is it that this much bigger bulgy region knows about this very central part of the galaxy, which in the central part dominates the mass, but as you go pretty far out, no one really cares about the black hole. I mean, it's like our sun orbits the middle of our Milky Way galaxy, not because there's a black hole there, but because there's about 100 million solar masses of other stuff within our orbit. At our distance, the black hole is essentially irrelevant. So black holes are not what makes stars in the main parts of galaxies orbit. Black holes only really affect, we would think, the central parts of galaxies. Yet, somehow, the bulges of galaxies know about the black hole in the middle because their size, and also to some degree how concentrated they are in their central region, is correlated very well with the black hole mass. And so this is something that a lot of my friends are working on. We're working on as well. And I'm part of a team that actually measured a lot of these black hole masses. The other evidence that we've had that there's giant black holes in the central parts of galaxies goes back several decades to galaxies known as active galaxies. So you have normal galaxies that have a concentration of stars toward the center, and then there are active galaxies whose central regions look way brighter, as though there were many more stars. But if you study the light from that central region, you find that it's not coming from stars. It doesn't look like starlight. It's coming from other phenomena. Yet there's a lot of it. So these are called active galaxies. They've been known for the better part of a century, actually, going back to Carl Seyfert in the 1930s. And then in the 1960s, quasars were discovered. And then it was found that the quasar is surrounded by a faint, by comparison, galaxy. Nevertheless, quasars are very bright events in the central parts of galaxies. And theorists quickly honed in, using plausibility arguments, on an explanation for quasars. They said that quasars, of which these 3C objects are, these are all quasars, they come from the third Cambridge catalog of radio sources, and they look like stars. Indeed, that's why they were called quasi-stellar radio sources. You can't even see the galaxy part in these pictures. But anyway, theorists said, well, these things, in a sense, have to be powered by lots of material falling toward a black hole. And while it's still outside the event horizon, but hitting other material, it will glow at a very efficient rate. You can make very, very bright central regions of galaxies this way if you're dropping a lot of stuff into a black hole. Again, the press gets this wrong very frequently. They're saying that quasars are places where a lot of light is coming out of a black hole. No, it's coming out from the vicinity of a black hole. But Martin Rees and Donald Lindenbell came up with this idea. And more recently now, we've made various measurements of active galaxies like this M87. And the dynamical arguments, the motion of stars, show that there is a black hole in this active galaxy. It often has a jet of stuff. Often you see these jets coming out of active galaxies. And there what we think is going on is kind of like a bigger version of what I showed you for a gamma ray burst. Material is accreting in, but a lot of particles are being energized by a lot of falling material in the vicinity of the black hole. And some of those high energy particles can escape, and they escape along the path of least resistance. It's hard to pummel your way through a dense accretion disk or a torus like this. If you're gonna escape, it's easier to escape along this path of least resistance. So you get these relativistic jets, and you see them in M87 and also 3C273 and some of other famous quasars. So there's a lot of evidence now going back to the early theoretical work in the mid-1960s that active galaxies have, as their power source, the accretion of material by a black hole from its surroundings. And now we've even found dynamical evidence for those black holes in the form of stars moving around really quickly in the central regions. So I would say that the evidence for black holes is now overwhelming. It's really very difficult to come up with an alternative hypothesis to explain the observations that we have. We should continue trying, of course, but I'm pretty convinced that these things really are black holes. So far from being just the figments of the imaginations of science fiction writers or of theoretical physicists, we actually think these things are real. And Einstein, perhaps, is sad here because one of the most magnificent predictions or possibilities in the universe, the black hole, He actually thought it doesn't really exist in nature. He just thought that the equations allow the possible existence of black holes, but nature knows of no way to actually compress matter to such a small volume. So I wish you were alive right now to see the evidence that astronomers have amassed for black holes. Maybe his reaction would be something like this. I don't know. It's conceivable that this is what his reaction would have been. You know, I just have a few minutes left because I want to leave ample time for questions, but let me dispel a few myths about black holes. The first that I hope I've already dispelled is that they just form for no good reason pretty much anywhere, like in Darren Belsky's apartment, kind of like Sid's room there that you saw at the beginning of my talk. Suddenly, through forces not yet fully understood, Darren Belsky's apartment became the center of a new black hole. Well, again, we think they form in the case of collapsing stars, or gas and collapsing in the central parts of galaxies, or maybe, more controversially, the data are still ambiguous here, maybe the central parts of some dense star clusters can form the so-called intermediate mass black holes, 100 or maybe 1,000 times the mass of the Sun. I didn't have time to talk about that. But they don't form in our room, so they're not going to form here at Rockland College. The other myth is that if our Sun were to turn into a black hole, which it won't, it'll turn into a white dwarf, about 7 billion years from now. But if it were to turn into a black hole, it would be really bad news for us because Earth would get sucked in. Because, you know, black holes are these giant cosmic vacuum cleaners, you know, that suck in everything from their surroundings. Well, that's not true. I mean, you know, it might be bad for Earth because we wouldn't have a source of light and heat. That would be kind of a drag, okay? But we wouldn't get sucked into the Sun because regardless of whether the Sun is a sun, a star, or a black hole having the same mass, one solar mass, we're so far away from this object that our gravity can be described quite well through Newtonian physics, and you know, there's no reason the black hole would suck us in. Our orbit would be unchanged if the Sun turned into a black hole. So don't worry, be happy. First of all, the Sun isn't going to turn into a black hole. Second of all, even if it were to do so, it wouldn't be a big deal, other than, you know, the fact that we're not what. So that's another myth out there. Black holes are dangerous if you get close to them. However, you might think that the big ones with a big Schwarzschild radius are more dangerous than the small ones. Turns out that's not true. The small ones in some ways are more dangerous because of what we call tidal forces. Near a small black hole, your feet are significantly closer to the center than your head is. And so the force on your feet is greater than on your head, and you get stretched apart. This physical principle, though not in the case of black holes, is the origin of Earth's tides. The moon pulls on the near side of Earth more than on the center, causing the near side to bulge out. It pulls on the center more than it pulls on the far side, causing the far side of the Earth to bulge out relative to the center. So you have two high tides on either side of the Earth. So these are called tidal forces. Well, near a big black hole, okay, one whose Schwarzschild radius is, you know, 3 billion or even 3 million, let's say, kilometers instead of only 3 for a one solar mass black hole, my height of 2 meters is not a significant part of millions or billions of kilometers, whereas it is a significant part of just a few kilometers. And so the tidal effects near a big black hole are much smaller than the tidal effects near a little black hole. So if you're an up-and-coming astronomy student, you want to do graduate work or undergraduate work, and you want to study black holes, and you find some spaceship that gets you near a black hole, choose wisely. Choose a supermassive black hole rather than a stellar mass black hole. Because if you get too close to a stellar mass black hole, big F, the force on your feet, becomes so much bigger than little f, the force on your neck or your torso, that you get stretched until you become long and skinny. And this process is formally known as spaghettification. See, we get stretched apart as we get closer and closer to a stellar mass black hole. Whereas this stretching around a supermassive black hole doesn't become really all that noticeable on a human scale until you cross the event horizons, or until you get very close to the event horizon. I'm not sure, it depends on exactly what the mass of the black hole is. But for a stellar mass black hole, even, you know, in the general vicinity of the stellar mass black hole, the tidal effects are so great that you get spaghettified. Finally, black holes can evaporate, and, you know, this is discussed a little bit in a book which I like to joke is the most purchased but least read through completion book in existence. Because it's pretty heavy going, but people have it on their coffee tables, you know, dining room tables, and then when they have dinner guests, the guests say, oh, you read Hawking's book, you must be really smart and stuff. Anyway, it's pretty heavy going, and he doesn't go into the details, which is what you really need to understand this, but the basic concept is thought to be correct, and that is that black holes might evaporate very, very slowly with time through a quantum mechanical process. And you can think of it as in many ways. One way you think of it is that particles are formed and then they tunnel out of the black hole, just like if I were to hit myself against this wall, if I do it enough times, you know, very many times, you know, a long, long time from now, I might emerge on the other side without having hurt myself. That's hard for a big particle like me. But for little particles, they might tunnel their way out. Or you can get electron-positron pairs forming in the vicinity of the black hole, and one of them, it doesn't matter whether it's the electron or the positron, it goes in, and because of a weird effect of relativity, from our perspective, the other one comes out with a positive energy, because the one that went in went in with a negative energy. And it adds, in a sense, negative energy, negative mass to the black hole, and that gradually decreases the mass of the black hole. Now, this process is very slow for stellar mass black holes and supermassive black holes. Indeed, they're eating material at a faster rate than they're evaporating. So all the black holes I've been talking about so far are growing in mass right now. But if little tiny black holes formed shortly after the Big Bang, having the mass of a mountain or less, like Mount Everest, then the ones less massive than Mount Everest would have evaporated by now, and the ones that began their lives with the mass of a decent mountain will be evaporating very quickly right now, because as the mass goes down, the evaporation rate increases, and at the very end, these things actually explode in a burst of gamma rays. Unfortunately for Hawking, these are not what we see to be gamma ray bursts. But anyway, this is all virtual particles. I described this to my elementary astronomy class on Halloween Day, and I dress up as a black hole, and here's an alien being spaghettified, okay? Take me to your leader. But anyway, I have a bucket of celestially themed candy. Milky Way bars and Mars bars and orbit gum and eclipse gum and things like that. And I throw these things out on Halloween Day to my college students, and they love candy, and so they always remember this lecture. All right. And then finally, suppose you were to throw your enemy toward a black hole, so you're Luke Skywalker and you're battling Darth Vader, and you say, die, you know, Darth Vader and Darth Saul, but Luke, I'm your father. Well, you know, it's the Emperor who was really the bad guy. Okay, don't throw me down the black hole. But Luke, you know, it's kind of too late. So anyway, you wouldn't have the pleasure of actually seeing him cross the event horizon, because it turns out that from our perspective outside the black hole, something falling into a black hole has a rate of time that is different from ours. And indeed, time slows down as the object gets closer to the black hole. And we've even seen this effect in your neutron stars. Here I illustrate it for a black hole. You synchronize two clocks at noon, far from the black hole, 4 hours may have passed, whereas when you're looking at this clock close to the black hole, 2 hours may have passed. And the closer this clock is to the event horizon, the greater is this gravitational time dilation. And it asymptotically goes toward infinity as you approach closer and closer to the event horizon. So in fact, you don't actually see anything cross the event horizon, because it would take an infinite amount of time to do so. You would see Darth Vader's flashlights fade, because the light would become gravitationally shifted to the infrared and the radio wavelengths, which you don't see. And moreover, because his clocks are slowing down, he would be emitting light less and less frequently. Not, say, 1,000 times per second, but once every second, and once every year, once every century. As he gets closer and closer to the black hole, all of his clocks are slowing down, including the rate at which he's emitting light. So he would fade from you, and you wouldn't see him cross the black hole event horizon for that reason as well. But even if he were to not fade from you, you would not have a chance to see him actually cross. So I think I said all that. From his perspective, he does fall in, because he's in his own frame of reference. Time is ticking away at the normal rate. And indeed, he would have a very short time after crossing that event horizon before being spaghettified in the case of a supermassive black hole, and then being crunched into the singularity, a point of, well, either point-like or probably some non-zero volume, but some very, very small volume, very high density. However, suppose Vader has this powerful rocket, and right before getting close to the event horizon, you know, while just hovering above it, he turns on this rocket and zooms away from the black hole and comes back to fight you. Vader will be much younger relative to Luke, because although Vader will have aged a little bit, Luke will have aged a lot, not being near the black hole. But being near the black hole, Vader will have aged very little, because time will have slowed down relative to Luke. So this is a way of jumping into the future. You won't read more books or see more Broadway musicals or whatever than whatever, however many months you spent by the black hole. But you will have jumped into the future by tens of years, hundreds of years, millions of years, an arbitrary amount of time into the future, depending on how long you spent in your frame of reference and how close to that horizon. So this is a way of jumping into the future without actually affecting your lifespan. But if you have loved ones and friends, you've got to make a difficult decision. You're never going to come back if you've made this choice to hang out near a black hole for a little while, because you can't go back. So anyway, and don't cross the event horizon, because abandon all hope, you enter here. All right, I went a bit longer than I hoped to, but I hope there's still time for questions. Summary, theoretical physicists said that black holes could exist, even though, you know, Einstein didn't think they do exist. Observational astronomers have found that they do exist, almost certainly. There's millions of small black holes, stellar mass black holes per galaxy, and there's one big one in almost every galaxy. Okay, a million to a billion solar masses. Black holes are detected not by, you know, taking a picture of them, but through their gravitational influence on their surroundings, okay? And then small black holes have greater tidal forces than big ones, so in a sense the small ones are more dangerous. You're more likely to be spaghettified. And finally, black holes can evaporate, but the process is negligible, except for miniature black holes, which may or may not exist. We just don't know. The jury is still out. Hawking won't win a Nobel Prize for his theory probably until one of these things is actually found. And, you know, maybe black holes of that size simply weren't made shortly after the Big Bang, and so if that's the case, we'll never find one of these evaporating black holes. But it's an interesting first important step in this desired unification between quantum physics, the physics of the very small, and general relativity, the physics of the very large. Okay, well, that's about it, and I'll be happy to talk more about that.
Questions, and when you ask the question, I'll ask Alex to repeat it so the rest of you can hear it.
Okay, right over here, yes.
Okay. During the design and building of the Large Hadron Collider, there were a lot of, you know, rumors and concerns that black holes could be created that would destroy the Earth. How were you serious physicists, how were you able to be confident that that wouldn't
happen? Yeah, this is a very good question. The question was, in the construction of the Large Hadron Collider, and even now, this continues, a lawsuit, I think, continues in Hawaii to this day, there's been concern that they would produce little tiny black holes and that those black holes would devour the Earth, okay? So what do we have to say about that? Detailed studies have been done, and we actually very much hope that these black holes might get produced, because if they get produced, they will provide indirect evidence for another spatial dimension. And if they don't get produced, then it'll be not evidence for another spatial dimension. But we're not worried about them because the very mechanism that allows their production is the inverse of this evaporation. So they'll only exist for a split second. So then the skeptic could say, possibly destroying the Earth is a serious business, okay? You better be darn sure. So suppose Hawking is wrong about the evaporation part, and also suppose it's easier to produce black holes than we thought. Well, even if we produce them and they don't evaporate, it turns out they're 1,000 times smaller than a neutron, okay? So in fact, they don't
interact with matter very often at all. And in I think the last lecture of this course here, I actually show a calculation of how often would the miniature black hole interact with matter, and how long would it be before even a tiny fraction of the Earth's mass was eaten. And it would be longer than the remaining lifetime of the sun. So there's essentially no danger because these things are so small and they never interact or almost never interact with matter. But yeah, physicists very seriously considered this because we don't want to destroy the world. First of all, our funding would get cut off and our laboratories would be gone. But you know, we have lives too. So it is a serious question, and there's like 100-page articles going into all the physics, and there's essentially no chance. Way up there near the back in the red shirt. Well, sort of burgundy. So how do supermassive black holes form? This is where I was a bit vague and hand-wavy because we don't yet know, right? All we can say is that we see them in the central parts of galaxies, and it makes some qualitative sense that that's where a lot of gas got concentrated to begin with, because indeed we see the stellar density going up toward the middle of a galaxy as well. So somehow, star formation was either thwarted early on and some of the gas fell in all the way and formed a black hole, or maybe one or a few massive stars formed early on and then they grew by accretion of material from the surroundings. But exactly how it happened is not yet known. Yes, sir, right there.
If a smaller black hole has a larger event horizon, what keeps it from growing,
So if a small black hole has a larger event horizon, what keeps it from growing? First of all, I think in speaking quickly, I misspoke. You know, it's not that the small black hole has a small event horizon. The event horizon is proportional to the mass. So it's for one solar mass, not that you expect such black holes, but if there were a one solar mass black hole, it's 3 kilometers as its functional radius. 10 solar mass black hole, 30 kilometers. Billion solar mass black hole, 3 billion kilometers. So the event horizon gets bigger, so in a sense the cross-sectional area gets bigger, but what I said gets smaller for the big one is the tidal effect, the differential force on your feet versus your head. Okay, so I just want to make that clear. However, it's still a fair question. Why don't black holes essentially eat all of their surroundings and quickly grow? Why doesn't the supermassive black hole in the middle of our galaxy pose any danger to us? It's because stars are only very rarely close enough to a black hole to be eaten. You even saw the orbits, the actual trajectories, at least in two dimensions, of the stars in the central part of our galaxy. Some of them got to within a solar system distance of the singularity, yet they still survive, because they're still far enough from the black hole that they don't get eaten. To be eaten by a black hole, you have to aim pretty well toward the black hole. And so the rate at which black holes eat material is very, very slow in practice. Way in the back up there, yes?
Going back to the bulge of the galaxy and the black hole, in addition to the vast black hole undergoing solar objects, there's also this stuff that we don't want to talk about, which is dark matter, which is gravitationally affecting the shape of the galaxy.
Right. Yeah, so the question is about the dark matter, most of which, as was correctly implied, is not the black hole. It's mostly some weird subatomic particles left over from the Big Bang. How do those affect the structure of the galaxy? They don't affect the structure in the very central region where the black hole dominates, but they do affect the halo of the galaxy, and therein lies the heart of this calculation that was done by the Texas astronomers that I mentioned, where they claim to have correctly taken into account the dark matter in the halo, and that then leads to a revised mass for the central part of the galaxy, 6 billion solar masses versus 3. And from what I understand, it's because a lot of the stars are on nearly radial orbits in M87, and so they're affected not only by the black hole in the middle, but also by the halo material out there. So yes, the halo material dictates much of what the galaxy's
you know, biggest parts look like. But the black hole itself only pretty much dictates the orbits of the stars in the very central region. Yes? Yeah, good question. The question isn't there a way to listen for black holes? And what you're referring to is that when a star spirals in toward a black hole, or if two black holes are spiraling toward one another, or by the way, even if two neutron stars are spiraling toward one another to form a gamma ray burst, you can, well, they emit gravitational waves, which are theoretically implied, and they've been indirectly measured, that is, we've measured consequences of the release of gravitational waves, but we've not yet ever detected a gravitational wave. Okay? But there are gravitational wave observatories, which we hope in the next 5 years will detect them. And if the signal-to-noise ratio is sufficiently high, you can effectively see changes in the orbital frequency of a star going into a black hole. And if you convert that into the corresponding audible frequency, you can then hear the two things spiral together. And without blowing my own horn too much, in my little teaching company course on black holes, I actually give you some of the different kinds of signals, depending on whether the thing is coming in along a circular orbit or a highly eccentric orbit, or going that kind of thing, you know. So yes, we hope to someday listen to them, but right now, most of the world's gravitational wave detectors have been turned off because they're being refurbished to the next step. Gravitational waves are very hard to detect, is the problem. So, yes, right there. Boy, you guys are great. Great questions, and there's so many of them.
Is it possible, or has there been an attempt to be stellar black holes in the globular?
Yeah, so the question is there any evidence for big stellar mass, or at least what you're meaning is the intermediate mass black holes in the centers of globular clusters? Yes, indeed, and this is what I mumbled very briefly. The so-called intermediate mass black holes may exist in some globular clusters and also some open clusters that are very densely packed. And in particular, there's been the claim that Omega Centauri has a 20,000 solar mass black hole in its center. There's been the claim, which is much more controversial, that M15 near Pegasus has a roughly 1,500 solar mass black hole. And one of the biggest globular cluster of Andromeda Galaxy, G1, which may actually be the stripped nucleus of a dwarf galaxy. You know, these big guys eat little galaxies and strip them away. G1 and M31 is such a big globular that a lot of people think that it's the core of a dwarf elliptical galaxy. Anyway, that has maybe a 20 or 30 or 40 solar mass black hole, 1,000 solar mass black hole. But the reason it's controversial is that there are still other ways to interpret the observational evidence that's been gained for star clusters. Whereas the stellar mass black holes, and to an even bigger extent the supermassive black holes, have less controversial evidence. In other words, there are fewer ways in which to interpret the evidence. Yes, right there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the question is, you know, are quasars really the creation of supermassive black holes in galaxies? And that's, yes, basically. The first quasars were shining, and, you know, because they were accreting a lot of material, and those are among the most distant objects known, okay? So definitely the birth of galaxies is thought to be associated with the birth of a quasar. But in many cases, the quasars either kept shining much longer than just the birth, or the black hole formed, and maybe along with the quasar, and then the quasar stopped shining because the black hole stopped eating material in its vicinity, and then billions of years later, the galaxy may have swallowed a Magellanic-like dwarf that then propelled new material toward the central region, allowing a rejuvenation, a rebirth of the quasar.